Welcome to the Texas Observer Podcast. I'm Dave Mann, editor of The Observer. We're launching a new series of podcasts. We'll have one every 2 weeks or so, we hope, if we can find space in our luxurious fallout shelter in the basement of our offices.
It's an actual fallout shelter.
Yes, we're not exaggerating about that. It is an actual fallout shelter, and we're very safe. Yes, we have the 1950s era sign to prove it. If there's a thermonuclear attack, the only people who will survive will be cockroaches and the Texas Observer. let's introduce the panel. We have two Texas Observer staff writers with us. Forrest Wilder.
Hello.
Welcome. We have also Melissa Del Bosque. Melissa.
Good to be here.
Thanks. And our special guest, Abby Rappaport.
Especially good to be here since I don't work here.
Yes. Recently the Texas Observer, now staff writer for the...
Anymore.
Yes. With the American Prospect. This week we're talking about the drug war in Mexico and border violence, and also the controversy surrounding women's health and the sonogram law. But let's start with the drug war. Melissa, you wrote a terrific story for the most recent issue of The Observer. You went to the Juarez Valley, which is a small farming community about an hour east of Juarez. Like, typically we talk about Juarez as, like, the most violent city in the world, but you go an hour east and there's a small farming community which actually is more violent than Juarez. Now, when I tell people about this story, the first reaction I always get is, well, what was she thinking going there? That sounds insane. Did you ever feel...
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah. Did you ever feel, like, unsafe there? And, like, what kind of led you to go to Juarez in the first place?
I started by meeting Saul Reyes, who is in this story and a very powerful guy from Guadalupe, this little town in the Juarez Valley. And I met him in El Paso in an immigration shelter. And he had just come across to seek asylum. And we started talking. And he was there with his kids and his wife. And just the things he was telling me were just incredible. You know, I mean, things that you would expect to hear from, you know, a war like in Syria, what's going on in Syria right now, just horrible atrocities. And the crazy thing is that these little towns are just right there on the river, on the Rio Grande, right next to Texas. I mean, you can see them from the highway in Texas. So all these horrible things happening to him and his family and his community. So I thought, this is just terrible. You know, this really has to come out, what's going on there. So from that point on, I was wanting to tell the story of Saul's family and all the things that happened in his community.
And they're the good guys. And we hear about the bad guys all the time, and you definitely write about them in the story because you have to. But, I mean, his family is basically almost wiped off the face of the earth because they had the audacity just to speak out against what was happening in their community from the cartels and the military, the Mexican government.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's now, I mean, I think people here in the U.S. have become sort of numb to reports from Mexico about the drug war because we've been hearing about it now for almost 6 years. And the coverage is so surfacey. It's not very in-depth, you know, either in Mexico or the U.S. Part of that is because of safety reasons. And there's so much going on there with the corruption from government officials, the military, and drug cartels operating there, that there's just a lot going on there that really hasn't been brought to light. So I hope to tell the story in a sort of organic way through Saul's family and through talking to other people in these small communities, because I really believe that the Juarez Valley is really a microcosm of what's happening in Mexico all over the place. I mean, I think there's a lot of Juarez Valleys, unfortunately, in Mexico right now. We just don't hear about them, and the news just doesn't get out because of the oppression.
I feel like that
oppression.
In the U.S., there's this conception that, okay, it's good guys versus bad guys, and you've got the Mexican police and military who are the good guys, quote-unquote, and going after the cartels, and... You know, it seems to be a very simplistic view. And one of the things I took out of reading your story is just how complex it is there, and that it's often hard to tell the good guys from the bad guys. Let's talk about a little bit about, like, I don't know, I mean, do you find the coverage in the U.S. of this situation to be kind of simplistic, you know, from a certain perspective?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, the U.S. coverage, I think we cover the Middle East better than we cover Mexico. And I don't know why that is, you know, because they're right there. I mean, they're right there on our front doorstep, just across from us. But for some reason, we don't get too in-depth into what's happening. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, you know, really exceptional stories. But mostly, we don't hear much other than body counts and sort of short reports about somebody getting killed or something like that.
Do you think that that's at all because, like, you know, I mean, it strikes me that, you know, if you compare it to, like, the Middle East, right, that you have kind of specific, the timelines are shorter with kind of, like, moments that are, you know, punctuated by, like, a specific uprising or a specific, and for some reason, the reporting of of the drug wars in Mexico, to me, it doesn't feel like that. It doesn't feel like the same kind of, you know, that it kind of feels constantly increasing, but never, not punctuated in the same ways with things that, you know, everyone can, you know, every newspaper can kind of swarm to Juarez to cover X, you know, which in a way is how I think Americans are used to reading about conflict. I mean, does this seem, do you have to take a different approach to it, or is it just we aren't doing as good a job because we're not doing as good a job?
Well, I think we just take Mexico for granted because it's right there. And you can just go there for the day and do a daily report of what's happening, maybe. And yes, I mean, you know, what's going on in the Middle East now, in Egypt or Syria, you know, people are there right now. And it is a conflict that, you know, started recently, whereas this conflict in Mexico has been going on since 2006. So I think there's a certain amount of malaise among editors, probably, too, in newspapers, where they're like, well, what's new, you know?
I guess what I'm wondering is, I mean, are there these, like, moments that kind of spike that we're not hearing about? You know, will there be, like, you know, oh, this one Tuesday in May when, like, things got really bad and, you know, people in the conflict know about these specific moments that we're not hearing about, you know what I mean, that aren't kind of piercing through, or is it more that it just kind of each day is a little bit worse and, you know?
I mean, Mexico, if I understand right, is probably one of the most dangerous places on earth to be a reporter.
There's just
that to begin with. You may have to state that just right away.
And the thing that's really bizarre about it is that it's also like a top tourist attraction. So there's this weird dichotomy, you know, where people are going there on vacation to Cancun and having a great time. And then there's people reporting, especially Mexican. I mean, it's very dangerous for Mexican reporters, not as much for U.S. reporters so far, but it's one of the deadliest places in the world for Mexican reporters. I mean, they've shot up newspaper buildings, they've thrown grenades at TV stations. I mean, there's just a massive censoring of Mexican media. So there's a strange dichotomy of, you know, you can still go there and have a great time in a vacation place, but then there's this conflict going on. So it's not your typical kind of war scenario, you know, where you expect to see devastated buildings. I mean, well, I did see that actually in the Juarez Valley, where it did actually look like a war. But in many parts, you know, you go to Monterrey and, you know, life goes on. People are going to the store. But then at the same time, there's this horrible conflict going on. And people aren't going out after 6 o'clock at night because they don't want to get shot. So
what struck me about your story was like the fog of war aspect. Like, there's such horrific violence going on. There's entire families getting killed, an entire police force being wiped out or fleeing. And yet, it's not always clear who's committing the violence, right? It could be one cartel. It could be the other cartel. It could be the military. It could be the police. It could be people dressed like the military. You talk to survivors who are saying, okay, yes, these horrible atrocities happened, but was it a challenge in reporting this story, not always knowing exactly who's committing what violent acts?
Yeah, I mean, I've really grappled with that because people have to tell you certain things and keep certain things back sometimes for their own safety and maybe even for your safety as a reporter. So I think what I've come to believe is that really the only way you could tell a story there is by sort of interjecting yourself in the story as a person in the story and saying, look, this is what people are telling me, but I don't really know for certain because the violence is so pervasive and there's police working for the cartels, there's cartel people dressing as soldiers. And so throughout this story, I was constantly asking people for details about what did the person look like, who did you, were they a soldier, were you, how are you sure? And at the end of it, it's really hard to tell, because there's just this revolving door between, you know, soldiers leaving, abandoning the military, going to work for cartels, and cartel people, you know, police working for the cartels. So at the end of the day, it's there's no good guy or bad guy. It's just very, very messy. And
but the official narrative in the U.S. seems to me to largely be it's the Mexican government, the Calderon administration, declared war on the cartels. And it may not be perfect, but largely it's the government trying to put down these violent cartels. But from the perspective of the people in your story, it's not that simple.
No, it's not simple at all. I mean, you've got soldiers working in conjunction with the cartel. I mean, even people telling me in Juarez that the cartel is the soldiers, you know, the military are the cartel. I mean, they're all
working together.
Right. There's all different sorts of theories about who is doing the killing. And
the violence got worse when the military showed up.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In 2008, when the military came into Juarez, the murder rate just skyrocketed. I mean, obviously something was happening there in conjunction with the military because the murder rate, I mean, you can't avoid the fact of the murder rate just skyrocketing. And that's when Juarez became the deadliest city in the world. And that's when the Juarez Valley became the Valley of Death. I mean, we're talking a 1,600 per 100,000 murder rate. And Juarez had a 250 per 100,000. And it was called the deadliest city in the world. So, I mean, the Juarez Valley, like, far, far, far outpaced Juarez. So I was hoping by looking at these small communities that I could somehow get a better understanding of how this conflict happened and how did the power structure work and who was killing who. And I don't feel like I have a definitive answer.
I mean, the story is pretty grim. I mean, you know, obviously, and I wonder, do you see any, it never seems clear to me what would make the situation better, right? Like, you know, when people talk about like the U.S. and getting involved, you know, I mean, that's
the U.S. is always involved, right?
Yeah, they are. I mean,
and guns, right?
Yeah, and military training. But I mean, I know what you're saying.
I think there's been a long talk, if you follow the GOP primary, though, of a very specific, like, U.S. I mean,
like
I think our
troops.
Governor
sending
talked
soldiers.
About sending troops.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, the U.S. is involved, but we're involved in so many places in different ways. But I guess what I'm wondering is, my question is more kind of what you see as being possible, like, pathways to more hopeful situations, or do you see any?
No, I mean, definitely. I mean, you know, my husband is Mexican, so it's like, you know, there has to be a hopeful path, you know, you hope. But I think the issue with Mexico and what we forget is that it's just became a democracy in the year 2000, 12 years. That's it. Yeah. I mean, it was a dictatorship before that. And I think people forget that, you know. So what Mexico needs is a rule of law and a judicial system that works. And the problem is that Calderon sent the military out into the streets before he fixed the judicial system and the rule of law. So if they had had a mechanism in place to actually bring people to justice and had rooted out corruption in the government, which actually I think is going to be really tough and a very, very long task, he should have done that before he sent the military out. And there are all sorts of theories about why he sent the military out. You know, I talk about it a little bit in the story.
Well, it was popular. I mean, that's one of the answers, is that politically, at least initially, it was popular with most Mexicans.
Well, and it wasn't, I mean, in the story, it wasn't like it was a perfect situation without drug cartels before. It was, drug cartels were integrally involved, right?
Right.
In kind of day-to-day life in Mexico before that.
Right. I mean, absolutely. In the government, and I mean, we see in Tamaulipas, which is the state just across from McAllen and Brownsville, that, you know, governors now are starting to be indicted for their involvement with the cartels. I mean, the cartels are very well ingrained in the political system. So
can I ask, kind of trying to bring this home to Texas and to the United States just a little bit. I mean, I think a lot of people have this idea like, oh, it's Mexico, it's violence, crazy, don't go there, don't travel there. And they're all killing each other, and I don't have anything to do with us, really. Other than if there's borders spill over violence, then we're going to smack them down. What is our part in this bloody drama as Americans and as Texans?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question for us, Wilder, because it's very just as much our war as it is theirs, because the reason that they're fighting this war is because we are the biggest drug user in the world. And all the cocaine from South America comes through Mexico into the United States. A lot of our guns go into Mexico. So, I mean, as a country, we need to look at our drug policies, and we need to really be realistic about it. We've been fighting the war on drugs for 40 years, and it's not a war that can be won. So,
wait, I'm confused. I'm sorry. I don't understand what you just said there, because you're saying the problem is we're using too many drugs, that the U.S. is using so much drugs, such a big consumer, that there's a demand. The war, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people might say that, well, then the war on drugs, which is supposed to be decreasing decreasing drug use, presumably.
Well,
are you talking about like criminalization
the war
of drugs?
On drugs,
and how does that impact
the war on drugs? Not going is up just through this vast sort of police system that's grown up around combating drug use.
Sure, but
I mean, we're more focused now on what is it, persecution or incarceration of drug users than we are on treating drug abuse as a health issue.
So if you think that we were doing more rehab, you think that would decrease the need for the...
But I don't think... But the level of violence was, although it wasn't non-existent, it certainly wasn't like it was now until, what, the 05, 06 kind of time frame?
Well, until the military were...
I mean, I think it's more about the enforcement side of things that led to this incredible spike in violence than anything else. I mean, the war on drugs is decades old now.
But isn't this also a consumer issue? And I'm not going to endorse drug use here, but... But let's be realistic. I mean, there's a lot of people that smoke pot and use cocaine, and maybe some of those people think about the provenance of other things that they buy, like their food, like where their meat comes from and where their vegetables come from. Is it at a point now where if you use marijuana in the United States, you need to think about where it comes from? And if you're buying marijuana that comes from Mexico, you are supporting this bloodshed.
Well, the demand for drugs is not going to go away. I mean, it's just not. So... the question is, how do we deal with that? And do we deal with it in a way where we're not devastating Latin American countries and other countries as much as we are now? I mean, I'm not a policy specialist in that area. There are lots of people who've dedicated their lives to studying that issue. So I don't have all the answers.
Well, what's the Mexican perspective?
Right.
Well, the Mexican perspective is that they're very upset because they feel like the United States is always pointing the finger at them and that it's their problem. And truthfully, I mean, yes, they've got to get a rule of law. They've got to reform their judicial system. There's a lot of problems in Mexico that need to be reformed. But at the same time, they're also right next to this country that is a huge, huge drug consumer. And all the cocaine's being transported here. And a lot of guns are coming through here to going to Mexico. So it's really a problem that we both share. It's not really Mexico's drug war, it's our drug war.
But now there's evidence, and certainly it comes out in your story, that the U.S. government, and especially the Mexican government, is working with the Sinaloa cartel, and maybe they're the chosen cartel somehow. And if that's the case, is that clearly not an ideal solution, but is that a solution? If you got it down to like one cartel that like was somehow kept under control, and there was drug smuggling, but there wasn't the violence, is that an actual strategy that could work?
Well, I mean, when I talked to, like, when I asked the mayor of Juarez, the previous mayor, you know, what is your idea of success? He said, well, my idea of success is that the problem just goes somewhere else, I mean, I don't think anybody in Mexico thinks that it's more a question of maintenance than it is of ever winning this drug war. It's getting it to an acceptable level where it doesn't affect the majority of civil society. So it really depends a lot on the elections in July that are coming up in Mexico.
And that's the appeal of the PRI, right? And that's kind of one of their selling points?
Well, I mean, that was the PRI's deal for 70 years, is that they...
70.
70 years when they were running Mexico, is that they sort of kept the drug cartels on a leash, you know. But I think the genie's out of the box. I think things have gone too far for them really to be able to keep them under wraps again. So, I mean, really what Mexico needs to do is it needs to eradicate this huge, huge gap between the poor and the rich, which just keeps getting worse. I mean, I really think as a country, the United States should be spending more money on helping Mexico rehabilitate its judicial system and eradicate poverty. I think we'd get a lot more for our tax dollars than we would with military training or selling them helicopters.
What if Rick Perry, Chuck Norris, and Ted Nugent went down there and just started kicking some ass? Would that do it?
Well, maybe we could put the royalties towards eradicating poverty in Mexico, and somehow the world would be right.
Yeah.
Okay, let's switch gears and talk about the controversy over women's health and the sonogram laws, which was a very hot topic this week. Abby, this seems to be operating on two fronts, like the first front being like the money issue, like the effort to defund Planned Parenthood, the controversy over Medicaid funding for family planning, which is something we saw happening in Texas. The other front being the sonogram laws. Now, we have a sonogram law in Texas that just went into effect, and that doesn't seem to be getting very much press. The law in Virginia is all the rage in the national media.
So popular. It's flying off the shelves.
Yeah. Like, I wasn't following the Virginia law very closely. I think I saw the Daily Show episode about it. But for, like,
obviously
those of
us... Obviously, you're reading my blog about it.
Religiously. okay, for those of us who weren't following it that closely, like, what happened in Virginia with this proposed sonogram law?
Sure. I mean, one thing I would just add to, like, what you described is that I think that, like, all these things have this weird connection in it. They're all... vaguely kind of just anti-women. Like, I mean, it took me a while to get to that point. I wasn't, like, on that bandwagon early on. But I think the trends are happening so many places. And, you know, so in Virginia, for people who haven't been reading the Richmond Pilot, I think that's the name of the paper there. But, you know, basically you had two big laws that were, or two big bills that were both getting debated. One was a personhood law. Now, that's something that has not successfully passed anywhere in the country, I believe, at this point. And it basically would define a person in the legal sense, so like the courts would have to determine, you know, as anything starting with a fertilized egg, kind of from there on. So that bill got debated and actually passed out of the House.
In Virginia.
In Virginia last week. And then this week was hitting the Senate, and on this past Thursday was voted out of the Senate Health and Education Committee. And I'll get to what happened there momentarily. But the other big debate was over a sonogram bill. Now, the sonogram bill in Virginia was very similar to one that had been debated in Texas last year during the legislative session. Very similar in that it was it had to happen 24 hours ahead of an abortion. You had to have a sonogram. The woman had to have a sonogram. The slight difference, the Texas bill required that the doctor read out a description of the sonogram, although made the actual description of the fetus optional. So the woman's obviously there having the sonogram done, but she doesn't have to look. I guess they don't, you know, keep her eyes open, and she doesn't have to listen to a description. Virginia didn't make that requirement about, you didn't have to even hear a description. However, Virginia's sonogram requirement would apply to rape victims as well, which was one of the key kind of exemptions that got established before Texas passed its version. The Virginia version, though, caught crazy fire. I mean, it just became huge around the country. And, I mean, to a shocking extent, because one of the things that kind of the pro-choice advocates were really successful on was making the point that a pre-abortion sonogram, because of the age of the fetus at that time, has to be a transvaginal sonogram, which is significantly more invasive. You have to have a probe actually going into a woman's vagina, as opposed to, you know, kind of what we think of as, like, the ultrasound, you know, on your tummy, kind of. And so people kind of got this messaged out as being about institutional rape and about kind of, you know, this real violation. And were extremely successful at getting that message forward. And, you know, you would have thought this was had never been discussed before. In Texas, we had a similar debate. And, you know, to their credit, I mean, I've never been shy about criticizing Texas Democrats. But actually, I think they were very upfront about that point. And, in fact, Carol Alvarado, a representative from Houston, I mean, stood on the floor with a probe, you know, and it was a really powerful image, actually, talking about what this violation would look like. But somehow it never caught fire. It really never, it never went anywhere. And so actually this month, as Virginia was debating its law, Texas was implementing its law and making it required for women.
Yeah, I mean, you wrote a story analyzing why the Virginia law or Virginia bill got so much attention when we have this law in place in Texas. And it got, like, nothing from the national media, which seems to love a crazy Texas story. And yet, in this case, it just didn't rate. I mean, why do you think it is that there are very similar laws, and yet in Texas, it just was nothing?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple reasons. In the story, I really explored this idea that I think is true to some extent, that kind of people write off Texas, you know. So I think we've seen in the past, like, month, I guess, you know, just a ton of evidence of, like, how, you know, kind of something going viral, getting some social media attention can really, like, change policy. I mean, we saw that with the Susan Komen stuff, you know, the debate nationally with the birth control panel where it was all men. I mean, that got this tremendous, I think, scrutiny because of Facebook, you know, because there was this great photo of, like, all the men, you know, no women there. And so, you know, I think there's this sense when people were, you know, kind of looking at the Virginia sonogram bill of, like, if we can get this message out there, you know, we can really put pressure and change the debate. And I think to some extent they were right. They, you know, if in case people haven't seen, you know, Bob McDonald, the very socially conservative governor of Virginia, actually, you know, rescinded his position on the sonogram bill and kind of said, you know, transvaginal sonograms are too invasive and we shouldn't do it. I don't think that would have been the outcome, even in a perfect world where people had flipped out in Texas. You know, if there's one thing Rick we know Perry about Rick wouldn't. Perry, I don't see him, you know. Yeah. Oh, actually, I've changed my mind. I don't think he does that often, unless, you know, a certain lobbyist is.
But I wonder if it's not
him.
Because this is a national conversation, though. I mean, it wasn't this women's health issues, contraception, abortion were really not in the top three kind of things that were part of the national conversation when the Texas legislature was, you know, passing this similar bill.
That's true, although here's an interesting point. So there's the personhood bill, right, in Virginia that also was getting a lot of attention at the same time, partially because of the transvaginal stuff, but it obviously also has major effects on birth control access, etc. Oklahoma has this personhood bill as well, but I don't think anyone knows about that.
Thank God for Oklahoma.
Well, right. you know, but so it's kind of an interesting, I mean, I think you're right that this is, you know, certainly become more of a national conversation. I think largely it's because the left has been successful in kind of taking the debate around choice and moving it from being about abortion, which is something people have very mixed feelings on and, you know, a lot of the country is kind of wishy-washy about, to moving it to be about birth control and about kind of reproductive rights in a much more broad way. And I think what they really did was took, you know, kind of brought a right-wing thought to its conclude to kind of the obvious conclusion, which is, well, birth control is a problem then. IUDs are a problem then. You know, and I think once you kind of were able to shift that conversation, you know, make it not about the abortion in the case of sonograms and abortion rights, but instead make it about kind of trans, you know, state rape, right? Like, that's a real kind of success in messaging, I think, over the past few months that we've seen from the
left. But you think boiling this down, I mean, if essentially, if you're trying to connect all the dots on this, that these are attacks on women.
I feel like it's harder and harder not to kind of come to that conclusion just based on how much it's happening around the country and based on the extreme. You know, I remember in 2011 sitting in the legislature when they were cutting women's health funding, and they cut it by 66%, right? And then we'll talk soon about kind of what that's meant in more recent decisions about the women's health program. But even before you were dealing with Planned Parenthood, when you were just talking about funding women's health, they cut it by 66%, largely with this idea that you couldn't really trust women's health providers because they'd all somehow, it all lead to abortion somehow.
The abortion industry.
The abortion industry. And even once they put in this, you know, very controversial rule, this that Planned, any abortion affiliates couldn't receive money, a rule that ultimately looks like it'll sink the entire program. But even then, they wanted to cut funding, right? Even after they said, well, we won't give it to abortion affiliates, we still have to cut 70% of the funding for the program. I mean, and it's happening around the country. And I think it's an extent, it's new in my lifetime, I think. You know, I think the debate has always been about abortion, you know, but I don't remember, you know, I was joking with my mom and saying, you know, I didn't know that, like, I needed to, that taking birth control was a political stance, you know? I mean, I just never thought that was an issue, you know, and I think it's a losing one because, you know, most people don't talk about abortion. Most people don't know if they know someone who's ever had an abortion because it's not something anyone really talks about openly or very rarely. Everyone knows tons of people that use birth control. In fact, you know, everyone knows tons of people who, you know, I mean, I think if you go to a college campus now, most people know someone who's used the morning after pill, you know, because those aren't, in most people's minds, related to abortion rights. They're a separate thing.
I think that's an interesting issue because it does seem like that there's a, like the backlash thing is happening, right? They've gone too far. In a lot of states, in Virginia, all across the country, there's this backlash. And certainly, I think, like, the Susan Komen deal representative of that.
Yeah.
But not in Texas. And I think it's interesting, we haven't seen that. I mean, I used to live in Virginia. You're from Virginia, right?
True.
We've lived in Texas. I used to think of Virginia as, like, the Texas of the East.
You should have a support group.
I know. But, like, yeah, when I lived in Virginia, you know, and I moved to Texas, they felt similar. I mean, Virginia is very conservative. They send a lot of people to the death penalty. Yeah. You know, it's a very rural state.
It's very southern, yeah.
Very southern. Like, but yet, you know, it voted for Obama in 08. It's considered a, you know, quote-unquote purple state. And yet in Texas, like, we are whatever, we're deep red, very conservative, very Republican. You don't see any of this kind of backlash going on. You know, we would never see Rick Perry back down an issue like that because it didn't have to.
Well, and for instance, the day after the Virginia kind of arguably hit its peak, right, with attention, which was Thursday when, you know, everyone's following the governor rescinding his position. The next day, Texas announces, we've decided to get, effectively, we've decided rather than keep our women's health program, we're going to punish Planned Parenthood and get rid of this program that serves over 120,000 poor women in giving them basic, you know, pap smears, cancer screenings, etc. You know, we're going to get rid of that. And I really haven't seen much on that today.
Yeah, let me interject with a very cynical sort of political viewpoint, because I worked in the Texas Senate for 5 years and watched it from the back row. I mean,
lucky
me, yeah. I mean, the difference between Virginia and Texas is that, I mean, the political leadership, I mean, how much of it was women health advocates having a really powerful message versus the governor of Virginia doing a very sort of political calculation? I guess he has aspirations to be vice president or, you know, a nominee. How much of it is the leadership in Virginia deciding, will this win me an election, this issue, or is it going to hurt me election-wise? Whereas here in Texas, I don't think the Republican leadership sees an attack on women's health or anything like that affecting them in the primary or in their political aspirations, which I think is a terrible shame. But I think there are political calculations made on this issue where they don't see it as a detriment to their advancement.
I think that in Virginia, advocates did a really good job messaging this and getting it out so that lots of people knew and were actually engaged on the subject. And then when they did a poll, not shockingly, people knew about this transvaginal stuff. They were very, you know, the message had gotten out. And so, yeah, when they did a poll, it showed overwhelming negative stuff on it. And McDonald, I think, very likely for political reasons, backed down. in Texas, I think that the question is larger, and this was what I kind of, you know, in a piece on it wrote about, is that you have, and I know, Melissa, you and I have talked about this a lot, a hugely alienated, disengaged, you know, swaths of Texas, right? That, you know, parts of Texas that feel like the kind of political outcomes are inevitable. And I think to some extent that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They're inevitable because people are disengaged and disengaged because they feel like they have no place, don't have a voice, and the outcomes are inevitable. But I do think that there's no, you know, if you look at when Bob McDonald chose to go against it, to change his opinion, well, I shouldn't say he went against the sonogram bill, but he went against the transvaginal component of it specifically. He's taking tremendous heat. You know, he's already getting, you know, lots of conservative groups kind of saying he's, you know, kind of broken promises, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's an inescapable part of this, is that you're looking at a just increasingly polarized electorate. And so in Texas, if you had a larger group of people engaged, I think you might, and you could message well. So those are two different things that would need to happen. I think that you could start seeing some shifts, but I don't think you should, you know, the people should kind of fool themselves into thinking, oh, you know, they could do it, just look at the poll numbers and make their decision. Well, 70% of people are against this, so I'll go that way. Because, you know, you have a very active and very vocal group on both sides of most of these issues.
Yeah, I mean,
so
it's
you're
not
taking
just
a
about,
big political risk either way.
It's not,
I mean,
just
I think
about
McDonald is taking a risk.
Poll numbers, but also about your consultants and who are those think tanks and those groups that you listen to that advise you on your
on what you can get away with.
On what you can, how you're going to advance your political career. And I think he made, in Virginia, I think the governor made an assessment, and I think he felt like that was not a winning equation.
But I guess I just think that the reason it wasn't a winning equation has a lot to do with the activism around it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? And so I think that the idea of, if you look at a poll in Texas, you know, what did people think of the sonogram bill in Texas? I think it was actually a majority supported it. But partially that was because it was called an ultrasound bill here,
right?
It wasn't called the transvaginal state rape bill, which is what was going out in Virginia. You know, most people, you know, it's kind of the when did you stop beating your wife question.
And actually, I mean, for me, it actually, the full impact of how invasive, literally and figuratively, this bill was, didn't hit me until the Virginia thing got the attention that it did. It like really just focused my attention just personally. And I was there in the legislature paying attention to this bill, thinking, wow, this is kind of crazy, but not getting the full kind of emotional impact of it until we had voices that were really articulating it well.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about kind of the national media right now is that, like, in state media, in Texas, everyone kind of focuses on their own stories. And so if the Dallas Morning News is doing something, the Houston Chronicle doesn't do it. And if the, you know, if the, they kind of let it be the Dallas Morning News story. And if the Tribune is doing something, the San Antonio Express News doesn't do it because it's a Tribune story, et cetera, et cetera. Ironically, I think with national media, particularly because so much of it is blogging and these opinion makers who have a lot of clout are, you know, it actually becomes the opposite, where I think, you know, one story can catch fire and, like, everyone writes on the same story. The problem with that is if it's Texas and no, you know, you don't get five, you won't get 500, right? And so in Texas, nobody was, you had a couple stories, but it never had a few. It was barely getting any national attention. In Virginia, it was like it started getting a little, and then it suddenly just got tons. And I think that's what you're going to see going forward with state policy, is that you either get 0 or 100% of national attention, and there's like very little 50%, and I think that's really a problem.
We had the budget, too, which was a dominant story.
Oh, that's but it wasn't a dominant national. I mean, most people nationally, you know, the way to really see how little of what happened in Texas legislature escaped is to look at what people were perceiving when they had Perry run for president. When Perry ran for president, how many of us talked to national reporters who had no idea that Texas had an unprecedented budget shortfall? You know, had no idea that Texas had just, like, slashed education by huge percentages. That didn't really make it out, I don't think, onto a national stage.
Well, and the sonogram law never came up.
Never came up.
Once.
And I think that, and what's important to note is Virginia's getting all this attention right now. There are 49 other states, and a lot of them are hearing some legislation that's pretty intense. I mean, you know, Idaho has gotten rid of its parks department, like pretty, like 80%, and within 2 years they want it to be completely non-state. I don't think anyone knows about that, right? I mean, you know, there are things happening around the country that are just kind of, if you hear about them, you think, well, why don't I know about this? And I think it's because it's like this zero, it's kind of a zero-sum game now with media attention, well, with this, national media attention.
Well, this, I was going to say, in this state, we've got, I mean, just to stay on a similar topic, we've got family planning clinics closing mm-hmm. because of the budget cuts you talked about, right. And the decision that we had this week to basically end the women's health program, which is Medicaid money that augments...
$35 million federal dollars Texas is choosing not to take.
Yeah.
Just because we don't want.
And that's always astounded me when I was working in the Senate, was how legislators could reject all this federal money because they didn't want to put up the match, which was a very small percentage.
Well, which in this case.
And yeah. In this case, it's even more bizarre because it's not the match. The reason they're choosing to forego the money is because if they got the money, they would have to allow Planned Parenthood-affiliated clinics and abortion-affiliated clinics to be in contention for the funds.
But the money doesn't pay for the abortions.
No. Nothing to do with abortions.
That's the thing that I feel like the general public is really confused
for abortions
on.
With government money.
It's just that it's going into this institution that that does abortions. It's like a tiny percentage of the total expenditures, and those dollars are coming out from the state government are not going to pay for that procedure.
No public money can go for abortions in Texas. So,
right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's totally true. And I think just the important thing to the Texas Press Corps credit, you know, is that if you read almost any story that came out this week about women's health in pretty much any medium, it began with 130,000 women, you know, may lose access to pap smears, cancer screenings, and birth control. And later on, it would say, you know, the concern was about whether it connected. But I think, to their credit, the Texas media is actually doing a pretty good job. We have a lot of media outlets here. We have more, you know, kind of Capitol Press Corps than most states. And yet it's not breaking through. And I think that's
a concerning trend. I think they did report it well. It was a women's health issue even a Planned Parenthood's case, like, yes, they do some abortions, but it has to be legally separate from everything else that they do.
That's just a liberal media bias.
but it often has
that liberal slant. Yeah.
But it's true. I mean, in the same way, if you want to go the other way, in the same way that a lot of religious organizations and churches get federal money to help the homeless, but federal money can't go to pay for proselytizing, and they have to keep proselytizing separate, legally separate from the government money they get to help the homeless. And that's the way that works, and the government keeps a really close eye on it, and the organizations make sure it's separate because they don't want to get in trouble. And it's the same thing here with Planned Parenthood, where government money can't pay for abortions, and they are. I've never heard of any money, you know, slipping through.
But I think the idea is that those dollars are fungible, and they're tainted by the association with an organization that is almost synonymous now with abortion in this country. Planned Parenthood equals abortion in the minds of the pro-life, anti-choice movement.
Okay, so the solution is that you're going to take money away from whatever, more than 100,000 women that are, these are non pregnant women, not getting abortion services, they're cancer screenings, they're pap smears. Okay, they're getting contraception.
That's a gateway drug to abortion.
Right.
I got no comeback to that.
I don't know. Maybe it's like the immigration issue where it just doesn't impact people until it affects somebody they know or their family.
But I think in Texas the question is larger than that, because I think people are being really affected. And, you know, I don't want to go on, but I mean, I think that it gets back to this question of engagement and of people feeling like they have some sort of efficacy. Because in this state, for a long time now, you know, we've been seeing policies that really affect people. And especially since, you know, the last legislative session, I mean, we were seeing kids going to schools that, you know, can barely keep the lights on, that have, you know, gotten rid of their entire, you know, making teachers be janitors because they've fired all their janitors, you know. And, you know, it doesn't get more real than that for people, you know, living like normal lives. And I think it's really a question of whether it's community organizers or national kind of movements or social media or what have you, whether there are ways to break through and kind of break through this kind of cycle of
apathy.
I don't think it's apathy. I mean, you know, we've debated this before, but a feeling that you can make a change.
Where is the outrage?
No, that's
my question.
But, I mean, there's this idea that, well, this idea of theory of revolution or reform or whatever, that, well, things need to get bad enough so people feel this material awful impact in a personal way, and then only when their backs are against the wall will they finally revolt. But, you know, I don't know if I buy that. I think that...
Well, and just to be clear, that's I'm saying the opposite.
No, I know that. Right. I because I agree with you, unfortunately, because I usually don't like agree with you. But,
mark this moment. But,
I will disagree.
But, like, this, I think what we're seeing is this slow degradation of the quality of life and the state. And I don't, there doesn't seem to have been a backlash other than a few kind of large, quickly fizzling manifestations that haven't turned into anything bigger. And I think it's because of the lack of an alternative, permanent alternative for people in some concrete way that they can, you know, say, all right, well, here's something I can sort of enlist.
Some change
with.
You can believe in?
Change you can believe in.
Well, oh, boy. On that note, yeah, I think we should wrap it up. I want to thank everybody for participating in the first of our new series of podcasts.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks with our second installment.